Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, the Speaker of the House will be here at MERS World Headquarters. That is Tom Leonard. He'll be talking about his upcoming run for Attorney General and the insurance package that is going through House Committee. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first, John, big news from Friday was Harvey Hollins finds himself in the news, apparently contradicting some statements that Governor Snyder made to a congressional committee. How far does this go?
Well, you got to remember, though, it's only a difference of about a month, depending on how you measure it and exactly when it took place. But I don't know. It's curious. I think what it's going to wind up being, really honestly, is a nick and one more nick in the armor of Rick Snyder. It's one more thing that's going to be out there when people think about his tenure. That headline that maybe he did, maybe he didn't lie to Congress, and maybe he didn't lie to Congress about Flint, which is the other big dent in his reputation. I don't know how you clear it up is the question that I really have. I mean, how do you make that go away? How do you answer it? And it's going to be interesting to see if he can actually do that.
Can he do that, you think, Jack?
I don't really think that this plays out in a matter that it's like so many other things, a little thing here, a little thing there, smoke here, smoke here, smoke here. And, you know, I think a lot of people who really have followed this administration can kind of answer this in the back of their minds, the continual communication problems and so on with this administration. It all adds up perfectly, but that certainly isn't something that helps the governor to say, well, it was just more of the same stuff, with not having the communications set up and this person, the left hand, not knowing what the right hand is doing or not remembering. So no, it's just more smoke among a whole lot of other smoke, and these things just, there's no way to make this ever look good.
It's got to be, and it could be something as simple as, you know, maybe the governor didn't remember that it was actually the mid-December before the holidays and that it wasn't mid-January or early January. I mean, it could be something as simple as that, or maybe it was referenced in passing in a litany of issues that his urban initiative director presented to him that he may want to think about, and maybe he was paying attention, maybe he was distracted. I mean, it could have happened in a number of different ways, and that's what's got to be, I would think, enormously frustrating for this governor, because, look, I mean, this is an issue that's going to define him no matter what, and now you've got one more kind of ding that is going to be incredibly hard to answer to and clarify and make go away, but it's going to stick in people's memory. This is the governor that presided over Flint, and this is the governor that may or may not have lied to Congress about it.
I think one of the things that you can say, Jacob, one of the knocks on this governor is that there seems to be this secrecy around this administration, and are they telling us everything that they know? And I bring this question up to you because of some work that you did on Friday in regards to how Snyder's Department of Environmental Quality was letting a private contractor use a website to hide documents from FOIA and basically admitting that that's what they were doing. I think there's a correlation here. I mean, this has been a knock consistently on this administration that they are not as upfront with the folks, with the people, as they could be.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, that is the key. And I think, you know, I think Governor Snyder and other people that campaign for office, you know, want to come in and campaign on transparency and cleaning up government and kind of things. And I think as they get into the job, it gets a little more complicated in terms of just how much control they try to put on what information gets out and what is distributed. And so whether it's, you know, avoidance of FOIA or, you know, getting a full, clear narrative on the Flint water crisis, I think there's a lot of effort to be done to kind of control what comes out because they're looking at all the consequences of how this is received. So, yeah, I think there is something to that. But I think, you know, a lot of people come into the office and say, I want to be more transparent. And they get in the office and they feel like they can't be just transparent because it's the nature of the position is one thing.
Because there's some things that you can't have out public, or else you blow up your entire agenda, or it doesn't feeling like you would release something may not portray the whole story. I mean, taken out of context, it can be blown up into something that it's actually not.
That's my theory, and that's my theory with my the story I worked on in particular, is that I think the administration and anyone in power doesn't want to give anything to anybody that can be fodder to be used against them, that the people might overreact to, in this case, like hypothetical oil spill data and things like that. So even though this is something that could be of public interest, I think just fearing that maybe an environmental group would jump on and kind of use this and kind of hijack the data in a way that could lead to a lot of, you know, public, you know, furor, I think what is the underlying motive here.
Well, I can't think of a better way to avoid creating fodder than sending having someone send out an email that, hey, we're doing the secret server so we can avoid and sidestep the state's Freedom of Information Act. I mean,
yeah, that doesn't look very good.
It doesn't look good at all.
For our listeners who maybe didn't read your story, can you just give a quick thumbnail, Jacob?
Yeah, so the state hired a contractor who has now been canceled to do a risk analysis on Line 5. And as part of the contractor's work, they had to put on a workshop to do one part of the report. And some of the materials that were made for that report, the state, working with the contractor, asked people not to release it. Some had raised issues about FOIA, that they would be subject to FOIA if they received these documents. So the private website on an FTP site that was controlled by the contractor was set up in that you could only look at the documents in a read-only format. And so it was actually said, typed out in an email, like the rationale, that if these people didn't possess these documents, they couldn't produce it in a FOIA. And at least one of our legal experts that we talked to said that a public record is something, a writing that is used by a public official. So even if they had used the document in their official capacity, it doesn't matter if they downloaded it or not, that would be subject to FOIA in some way if a request covered it.
Yeah, that's going to be hard to prove, though. I mean, to view something, if you viewed something on a website, now does that automatically become a public document? So if a state bureaucrat's shopping on Amazon, is there any way that I can get that?
Well, and that is tough. I think the point in that is saying that FOIA covers these things, even if they're hard to get to, but FOIA is trying to say, like, these are the things that are covered. For example, private emails, right? Like, private email that a government person is using in their official capacity, that is covered under FOIA. That's different than, like, how difficult it would be to acquire those. Like, objectively under the law, there are situations where the private email would be covered by FOIA. But if you don't know those exist, that the person searching the records for you doesn't know about it or knows about it and chooses not to include it, I mean, that's a whole other issue entirely. Yeah, so you're right. Like, that is hard to prove. But the point is, the law covers it, but then the practicality of actually getting it could be difficult. You're really relying on the state to carry out FOIA to its full extent.
Well, I'm going to give you some quick prediction here, my prediction on what happens here with this Snyder-Harvey Hollins thing. Even if the Republicans in Congress want to bring Snyder back up and clarify what he meant when he said that he didn't know about the Legionnaires outbreak until January 2016, when Harvey Hollins said he told him in December of 2015. I think the governor is got pretty apt at being able to get out of these types of sticky situations by saying that maybe it was brought up at a meeting. I mean, we don't really know the context about how it was brought up. It was not in any maybe official capacity. I mean, who would be in charge of actually telling the governor of something this severe? It would be his Department of Health and Human Services director. I mean, that's when you get the official word. It's kind of like an analogy that I would make is, well, geez, I got some kind of chest pain, and my wife thinks that maybe it's this or that, and you know, so she suggests it or thinks, oh, you know what, that's kind of like what I had. I mean, maybe you have X, Y, and Z, but you didn't find out until a month later when you went to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, yeah, you've got some clogging going on. I mean, so when did you find out? Did you find out when you first felt the pain, when your wife told you, when this happened, or did you find out officially when your doctor told you? And I think that this is one of those situations where he's going to be able to worm out of this kind of box that he's in because of that.
Yeah, and I think John kind of put that well earlier. Like, was it kind of buried on a list of things that were talked about that Harvey Hollins needed to talk to him about? I mean, did Nick Lyon, you know, I think, did Nick Lyon come to him in January and talk about the deaths, right? Or the outbreak? And maybe Harvey Hollins talked about just there are some Legionella issues. I don't know. The point in you're trying to say is there's a lot of context that's missing, and we don't know because the testimony was not completed as far as we know. So there's a lot more that needs to be answered for us to understand what happened.
And that hearing won't resume until the 10th of November.
There's going to be a lot of time to sit around.
There's a lot of time for that thing to just kind of lull it around the table.
I think it also, the question also has to be asked, what difference would it make if he had said early December? Would have made any difference whatsoever to Congress if he had a note on that it was brought up in early December instead of January? Was there any difference that it made in the long run?
Those are good questions. I just, the two things that could come out of it if people want to make this an issue is, one, the whole trustworthiness thing, right? Like, are you true to your word? Do you say the truth, even if it's a month off kind of thing? So the whole credibility thing. But the other thing is just the narrative early on in the Flint water crisis was the Snyder administration did not move fast enough. Like, when was this declared emergency? When did you know about this? And so I think that folks that want to make this an issue could certainly like resurface that narrative and say, and add this chink to the armor kind of thing. So those are good questions to ask, like, what difference does it make? But I think people could make that an issue, and whether that resonates, we'll find out.
All right, we're going to move on, Mike, to the House Insurance Committee, which you spent a lot of time in last week. God bless you. You've learned a lot, I'm sure, about insurance in the state of Michigan now that you didn't know before. Where are we at with that? I mean, are we going to get some movement?
We've had two hearings so far. Lana Tice is eager to move the bill. She says she wants to give everybody a chance to speak their piece. That was the reason why she went so late last Tuesday, was to make sure that everybody had an opportunity to speak. And as she says, she had some people who were disabled who came to speak. It's not that easy for them to travel, so she wanted to make sure they didn't have to come back. I think it's pretty clear that she's not going to... She hasn't said that she will give any hearing to the alternative plan, the CPAN plan that was talked about a couple weeks earlier. And right now, it's not clear whether or not she's going to bring in House Fiscal Agency to testify on their analysis, although people on both sides of the aisle in committee did ask for that testimony.
Seems like the Democrats are falling off. Whatever few Democrats we had, they're certainly not gaining any as this process moves along. They're only losing people.
That's what it looks like, although I was reminded on Friday that could be posturing to get more for them to get better negotiation leverage.
Jack, why does this look really familiar? Haven't we danced this dance before?
Well, it's time to think about, do you want a topic that you're really going to love and that's going to be real clear to the average person? You wouldn't pick auto insurance. And then you add into the Michigan, in Michigan, you know, years ago we added one more moving part with the catastrophic claims thing. And this has got so many moving parts in it. To try to herd people together to get agreement on any kind of major changes, it's just so difficult to do. There's just so many angles and there's just so many interested parties that, you know, to try to get everybody on the same page, I think, is an extremely difficult task. And no matter how great it looks at the first press conference when you have everybody and their Aunt Lillian standing up and saying, oh, gee, this is really good, you know, this just shows you it falls apart in about a week.
It seems like at what point is it kind of a bargaining kind of situation where you're negotiating about, okay, we're okay with this piece of it, we're okay with this piece of reform, and then when you finally come to an agreement about what you're going to include in the final package, is it even worth doing? And I think that's where we've been at before with this auto no-fault thing, and that's why it's never moved before. Everybody's okay with doing some kind of fraud authority, But then it's like, okay, well, then what does that look like? How much authority are you giving the fraud authority? And is it then at this point even worth doing? And I think Brian Kelly brought this up at the island. Maybe this is what we, one of these situations where we do got to do it bit by bit, piece by piece. Okay, we'll handle this. We'll just to get the ball rolling, maybe we have to pass a couple of the low-hanging fruit, John, like telling folks who are on Medicare, you know what, you really don't have to purchase personal injury protection, really.
The problem with that approach is it's sort of like paying Earl Scheib for a new paint job on a car that won't start. I mean, it's still a broken car. It just looks a little better. And you can say that we actually did something about it, but it's still a broken car. Look, the tough part about this package is the same thing it has always been. If you're a Republican, this package is telling the private sector exactly what to do and dictating how they should operate. If you're a Democrat, you're cutting benefits. I mean, it's like you're giving both sides something equally to hate in this package. So how do you get somewhere in the middle that actually solves the problem so we can have a car that starts and looks good?
A car that starts and looks good. I don't know, John. We haven't been able to get it off blocks for about, 15 years, 20
years?
As long
as I've been here, I think.
All right. Well, maybe the magic man who's joining us right now will be able to shed some light on it, House Speaker Tom Leonard. Thanks for coming up here.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
We're looking forward to getting one of your Attorney General signs now for our wall downstairs. Join all sorts of other folks like Gretchen Whitmer and
Kid Rock.
We don't have Kid Rock.
Okay, we'll get you a state rep one soon, and I should have the placards done in the next week or so. We'll get you one over here.
All right, sounds good. So today you announced you are running for Attorney General. We thought, boy, it's only been a couple weeks after the Mackinac Policy Conference, we thought maybe you would have announced then. Talk about the timing and how that all went down.
Well, you know, this is certainly something that has been a passion of mine for some time since I was a prosecutor for Genesee County nearly 10 years ago. And certainly there's been a lot of buzz, but we wanted to use that time on the island to really talk to the grassroots just about the shared values, try to figure out how they felt we were doing here in the House, how I'm doing as Speaker. And certainly we had a very successful conference. You know, obviously I was not a declared candidate at the time. We came off the island and won the straw poll 2-1. So that was a huge sign that the grassroots were really looking for a strong conservative to get in the race, and that really gave us the bump that we needed to make that decision and jump in.
One of the things I want to ask you, obviously you're familiar with the current Attorney General, and even Republicans would kind of want to know, how are you going to differ from Bill Schuette if you're elected?
Yeah, so, you know, it's very difficult to compare myself to other individuals. What I do know is this, is that every attorney general has his or her, or puts his or her fingerprint on the office. When you look at Frank Kelly, he did a great job with consumer protection. When you look at Mike Cox, he really went after those deadbeat dads. When you look at Attorney General Schuette, he has been a voice for victims. Some of the changes that I really want to see implemented, there are three things I really want to focus on as the next Attorney General. First is protecting our seniors, protecting the elderly. The second one is continuing to combat go after or help those that suffer from mental illness. You know, mental health has been a big issue and passion of mine since I've been here. And the third is tackling this opioid epidemic. Now, if I could go back to the senior piece for just a moment, when I was a prosecutor, I had the opportunity to work on our elder abuse task force. There was a task force in Genesee County that was specifically assigned to investigating and prosecuting elder abuse here in the state of Michigan, and it was very successful. That is something I really want to focus on as the next Attorney General. I believe that there ought to be some type of statewide task force. There ought to be something in that office that spends all of their time protecting our most vulnerable, and that being our elderly.
You know, there's been discussion throughout session about Tom Leonard. He's running for Attorney General while being Speaker of the House, even though you weren't a declared candidate. Kind of speak about how that division is in your line, or if you think that the two kind of go together in a way.
Well, you know, I mean, few would argue that I'm not one of the hardest working people in this town. I've got a strong passion for it. We've seen the success that the House has had over the past 9-10 months, but certainly I believe much of it does go hand in hand. When you look at the issue of mental illness right now, I mean, that has been a huge passion of mine. We are doing great work on that in the House. I recently appointed a bipartisan task force, and I'm going to continue to keep my foot on the gas pedal. That's something that we certainly want to continue to tackle, this opioid epidemic. This is something that we're not going to punt or hit the pause button on until the next attorney general takes his or her seat. We're going to continue to work diligently to solve this crisis. So when you look at my issues and passions of mine, certainly they align with many of the things that I've been doing as speaker, and look forward to accomplishing much over the next 15 months.
So going forward, you don't think there'd be any conflict in the future between what you're doing now and running for attorney general?
No. You know, John, outside of my family, you know, my beautiful wife, Janelle, and wonderful daughter, Hannah, my first priority is going to be Speaker of the House. I know that I've got to continue to make those tough decisions. I know that I've got to continue to tackle those big issues. You know, I've told my my caucus repeatedly, I believe the best politics is tackling good, sound, and strong public policy. So I'm going to continue to do that over the next 15 months, and I believe that will bode well for Republicans across the board if we can do that.
And to be a bit more specific, so one of the criticisms I've heard is that the speaker's doing this or that so he can win delegate votes. The reason you're taking up an income tax rollback is so you can get votes on a convention floor. Can you address that? Because I'm sure you've heard this as well.
Yeah, absolutely not true. I mean, what I would say to that is, say that to a supermajority of our caucus that wanted to vote. There were 12 people that held out, Republicans that held out, didn't want to vote for that bill. I would say the same thing to that supermajority of our caucus and see what they would say. That was a situation where a supermajority of our caucus wanted to stand up and they wanted to take a principled stance for those who had fought tooth and nail to get us here and give us a Republican majority. But look at the good jobs package. I mean, even though I voted no, I took a lot of criticism from our grassroots because I allowed that to come up for a vote. But that was a situation where not only did we have a supermajority of our caucus that wanted to vote on that, but we had a supermajority of the entire House. So, you know, certainly any criticism that I would be putting Attorney General before Speaker, I do not believe is founded. You look at that good jobs vote, if I was putting Attorney General first, certainly that would never come up for a vote.
As you're looking ahead toward a convention fight, is there any type of a path? I mean, what is kind of the path you see? Because these are very parochial type battles. You know what I mean? I mean, you're not appealing to a general population. So how do you get like that 1,000 or 1,500 votes that you need to win?
Well, certainly when you are looking at a convention, these are the individuals, these are your grassroots activists. These are the ones that are most up to date on the issues. And generally speaking, these are the ones that are most conservative. And, you know, certainly if you look at my record, I didn't recently become a conservative because I wanted to pander to delegates. I've been a conservative since the day I got here, and I'm proud of my record. And I believe they've seen that, and that's why we came off the island with a 2-1 victory in the straw poll. They've had an opportunity to examine my record. I believe they're proud of what we're doing here in the House, and you know, certainly this is one of those things I look forward to continuing to take our message to them.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring up, too, you had a barbecue or a picnic or something at your house around the 4th of July. Is that right?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Tell me about that, because I only saw the pictures, but it looked like you had more than friends and family there.
We did. This was certainly, I wanted to do something to thank the grassroots activists for all that they do. Again, looking back at the 2018 election, Republicans never would have been successful. Donald Trump would not have been able to carry the state by 9,000 votes, and the House would not have a 63-seat majority if it wasn't for the great work that the grassroots activists did. They were fired up. They were hitting doors. They were making phone calls. And one of the big complaints that I've heard from them throughout the years is they often feel like they've been forgotten. And I used to be one of them. I was a precinct delegate for several years before I came to the House. I was a county party chair. I was on the state committee. And I know they often feel like they are forgotten by their elected officials. So this was one of those situations where we sent out an invitation to several hundred grassroots activists. I truly felt at the time it was going to be me flipping burgers for about 75 people that would show up at our home. And about 4 or 5 days before the event, Janelle, my wife, asked me how many people were going to be there. I didn't know. So I was rummaging through my email, and I called somebody that was helping us put it together, and he advised that we had 450 RSVPs. And we had nearly 500 grassroots activists show up. Fortunately, within a few days.
To your house?
To our house, yes.
Did you need to bring in like porta potties?
We did. We had to bring in two tents, two porta johns. God bless her, my mother-in-law came up from Indiana to cater the event. We had pulled pork. We had barbecue. It was a great time. But again, I wanted the grassroots to understand how much we in the House truly care about them and appreciate the efforts and what they've done to put us in majority.
Wow, that goes from just bringing a dish to pass to like planning. Janelle must have just had her jaw drop on you, didn't she?
Yeah, if she had not asked that question 4 days in advance, we may have had a disaster because I don't think we'd have had the porta-johns in place.
Do you have a septic or you got municipal?
No, we've got municipal water, but I don't even know if that can take care of 450 people flushing the toilet at one time.
Make sure you clean the bathroom before they all
you
come.
You got it.
Boy, that's a heck of a... a heck of a turnout. What day was it on? Was it on the 4th or the...
No, it was on a Saturday. It was in July. Okay. I don't know the specific date, but it was in the middle of summer and it was on a Saturday.
Yeah. You got an update for us on the auto insurance?
Yeah. So I am still cautiously optimistic we can get this thing done. So early next week, I will be caucusing with the rest of the caucus. At this point, aside from myself and Representative Tice and the dozen members or so that serve on the insurance committee, a lot of our members really are not up to par on this issue and know exactly what this legislation does. So before it's voted out of committee, we certainly want to caucus on this issue for a couple hours, answer any questions that they may have, and certainly see where the Democrats are going to be on this issue. You know, I've been very clear from the start. We're not going to get this done with just 55 Republicans. It's going to take a bipartisan effort. We are probably going to need 10 to 15 Democrats to help get this done and get it across the finish line. So I certainly want to give the mayor some time to work this issue and some folks within the Detroit delegation to see if we can't get those 10 to 15 votes, we're going to need to get this done.
What's your take on Mike Duggan?
He has been an incredible mayor. He has done a great job. I mean, when I go back and all I remember are the days of Kwame Kilpatrick. When I was in law school, reading the headlines every day about the disaster that he was. And when I look at the job that he has done, the common sense that he has brought to the city of Detroit, the fiscal responsibility, certainly the mayor and I don't agree on everything. But he has been a godsend to the city, and he's done a great job.
Certainly, we won't know until the vote is actually cast, but what's your sense of him as a legislative networker or maneuverer?
Well, we'll see. I've got some faith in him being able to deliver Democrat votes on this package of bills, but this is really the first big issue that I've worked with him on. He has been great to work with. He has built a strong coalition. We will see at the end of the day, can he truly deliver the numbers that we need. But so far, he's done a great job building the coalition that I feel we need to get this done.
I've been hearing that the Democrats may have a caucus position against fooling around with PIP choice. I want to get your reaction to that. And I mean, that would be a major impediment because it's a big part of your plan.
This is the first that I've heard that. If it's true, it would be very disappointing. I mean, many of the citizens in the districts that they represent, particularly in our urban areas, when you're looking at Detroit, when you're looking at a Flint, when you're looking at a Saginaw, those are the citizens that are hurting the most from these astronomical insurance rates. So the fact that if that's true, if they do want to take a caucus position and take off or take away the one part of the plan that would truly deliver cost savings for their citizens, that would be very disappointing. And I would hope that they wouldn't go there, not for my good, but for the good of the citizens that they represent.
Because this includes a rollback, right? So they would, in essence, be voting against lower insurance rates.
Correct. I mean, at this point, the only way that we can ensure a substantial and significant rate rollback would be for there to be a PIP choice option. And that's what that $250,000 option does. It would reduce those PIP rates upwards to 40%. And that's anywhere from 20 to 40% of the entire premium, depending on how your rates are calculated. So I was speaking earlier to the press and, you know, told them this is a situation where if they would get on board, particularly the citizens of Detroit, they could save upwards to $1,500 to $2,000 per vehicle. These individuals, they really need help, and I would hope they would not take a position that would not be in the best interest of the citizens they represent.
Last thing I wanted to ask you about before we let you go, who's your candidate for governor?
I have not made an official endorsement in the governor's race at this point.
Are you going to, do you believe?
At this point, I do not plan on making one.
Okay. Keep your options open.
You got it.
All right. Sounds good. Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, thanks for joining us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, John, Jack, Mike, and Jacob, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all the other podcasts. Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, for coming in. And John, it sounds like we've got, if we think that we have a small town here in Lansing, you found a town and a capital city in this country that's even smaller than this place.
I spent the weekend in Jefferson City, Missouri at their capital there. It's a beautiful building. It looks like you could hit it with a bomb and it wouldn't fall down. It's that massive. But it's a very small town, 35,000 people, and it was just a nice little Midwest small capital.
So the whole town could probably fit in the capital.
The whole town could fit, yes, in Washington, but yeah.
Yeah, probably. And probably the buildings and everything else could fit in the Capitol.
I don't know about in the Capitol, but I mean their Capitol building is actually bigger than ours. But
is that right?
Yeah, it's structurally it's a huge.
Is that where they have their offices and stuff?
Yeah, they have their Capitol building is big enough to house the offices for all their lawmakers and the governor and the lieutenant governor and the treasurer and secretary of state.
I mean, wow,
it's a big building. But
so no controversial bond deals with separate buildings for lawmakers then.
No, we don't need any of that.
No, so long-term leases with the multi-million dollar buyouts for special people.
Huh, so they're not housing their folks with lobbyists then?
Nope, apparently not.
Interesting. All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the podcast. John didn't mention the Michigan State score. I'm glad I was wrong. That's all I'll say about that. Until
I think everybody was wrong. We should play back that.
I thought we were going to talk about that.
We should
give John credit for voting with his heart and not with, like...
Hey, man, he's done it 8 times now. Like he said, nobody should be surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, Antonio. Well, I'm just happy to say that I'm blissfully glad I'm wrong again. And it took me until about the third quarter until I really believed it was going to happen. When the wall of rain came down, and I realized nobody's going to move the ball on that thing.
It took me till the clock said zero to believe it was bad.
Until the final pass fell down on the ground at the end of the game. Oh, all right, that means we're done.